Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 24th, 2004. Today's session number is DYL-2004-05. Today's speaker is Laurel Dykstra. The lesson for today is The Other Side of Exodus, Strategies for Living Justly. But what can we do? Let's listen in.
What does it mean to be an Egyptian allies of God's program of liberation? How can we be Egyptians who act for the Hebrews? So we're going to look at some texts first, and then we're just going to have a little time of resource sharing. When we fill out for the media people what kind of class this is so that they know how to file it in their library, this is, I think, down as either social justice and lifestyle or Bible and lifestyle. So that'll kind of give you an idea of what we're looking at. Let's go around and have each person say their name. And let's see. Say your name, say where you're from, and say something about why I decided to come to this class today. I'm Laurel. I am currently living in North Vancouver, British Columbia. And I'm coming here a little bit scattered to kind of wrap up the week.
I'm Hugh from Columbus, Ohio, and the topic was interesting, so I came.
I'm Joyce. Actually, I live in Worthington. He lives in Worthington. We're in the suburb of Columbus. And we just never had the opportunity to make it. We've only been here a few days. And somehow there was a conflict, but I don't remember what it was.
I'm Maureen from St. Paul, Minnesota. I've been in most of the earlier sessions, and I have a great interest in the topic.
My name is Britta, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. And this topic does seem interesting. I haven't been able to come to other sessions, so even though I'm leaving today, but I thought I'd like to come to the last one at least.
Great. My name's Jan, currently from Western Nebraska, and I can see the problems. I'm looking for solutions.
I'm Val, and I'm from Anchorage, Alaska, and I work in the Hike House, but I don't have to work this morning, so here I am. I work part-time.
I'm Fake from New York State, and I'm here on the last session because I've been following two of the other studies, and between that and having my grandchildren and children here, that's about all the time I can spend at once. So they're off on a hike today, and here I am.
Okay. Well, what I'd like to do then is we're going to look at two different biblical passages from the beginning of Exodus. They are kind of women's resistance stories. And what I'll get folks to do is just kind of number off 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1. The ones will read the first passage, Exodus 1, 15 through 22. And the twos will read the second passage, Exodus 2, 1 through 10. The folks who are doing recording could stop for a few minutes and we'll do a small group. Take a look at that passage and then group up with sort of ones over here and twos over there and just discuss a little bit what you notice in the passage. What's the passage about? What happens? And something that we've been doing through the week that some of you will be familiar with and some of you will be kind of new to is look at what might be modern parallels. What do you see in the life that you live now that might be like this story? So while folks do that, I'm going to beetle across the street and get a copy of my book so that I've got something to refer to.
Well, yeah.
Recording back on, and what we'll do is report back to one another from the two different groups. So if we can get the midwives to tell Pharaoh's daughter a little bit of their story and to get Pharaoh's daughters to tell the midwives their story. And you can sort of recap the plot, you can tell about what insights you had, and just a little bit of back and forth. Anybody who's sort of bursting to go first?
Well, midwives got there before the Pharaoh's daughter, so
seems fair enough. So midwives?
Well, I decided to be an Egyptian midwife because I thought probably since I was part of the culture, I could do things that maybe the Hebrews couldn't do, and I would maybe get in less trouble. I might get, I might get in trouble, but I probably wouldn't be killed because I was an Egyptian, and I probably had more connections to do something with these babies, and I would stir up other Egyptian women to follow God rather than follow the king.
Midwife or not.
And you can just share observations that you had as well. Yeah.
Something you
want to
say?
Oh, the only thing I observed was that you in your story mentioned the Underground Railroad, which would be a modern day example of this situation.
Well, in the story, the king of Egypt orders the midwives to kill the boy, Hebrew boy babies, and let the girls live, which, of course, is the opposite of what Hebrew society is based upon, the male being the important member of the family. So, I as a Hebrew...
Is it the opposite, or is it the recognition?
What?
I say, is it the opposite, or is it the recognition that the boys are important?
The recognition. And so I, as a Hebrew midwife, chose not to obey the order. I knew that I would get in trouble also, but I let the boy babies live, and I let the girl babies live, and then I sent them on the Underground Railroad to escape, and so none of them were killed, and I was, the right to be a midwife was taken away from me, which was probably a small penalty compared to what it might have been in reality, but that was my story. I couldn't be a midwife anymore.
I went first being a midwife, and I didn't really go much beyond the story as it is, but just how it felt to be given this wrong order. I did think of myself, although I didn't explicitly say it, as an Egyptian, because as we've been talking to the Bible is ambiguous about whether the midwives are Egyptian or Hebrews themselves. And I was thinking of myself as an Egyptian, but just refusing to follow an evil order and then telling a story to try to kind of make it easier on myself.
So do you folks have any questions or clarifications, or shall we? Anything that you want to ask the midwives?
I love the humor in it, because in their verses where the midwives say, well, these Hebrew women are so vigorous or whatever it is, that they just have these babies before we get there. We can't do a thing about it.
Yeah, that bears some looking at, because they're sort of capitalizing on this derogatory stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean? Because certainly you hear things like that today. You know, there's lots and lots of modern analogs to the, why do these people have so many babies? You know, why do people have children that they can't afford to look after? Well, you know, it's not the same for them. They don't need to have a hospital birth. You know, so there's a whole lot of analogs to that.
But it's also, our daughter had two of her three children at home with a midwife. And because she felt that it was not a hospital event. The only reason the second one was born in the hospital is because Arizona law said that if you were overdue a certain amount of time, you had to go to the hospital.
Yeah, there's a real contrast between sort of the high risk of death from childbirth that kind of pervades society and history, and then the over-medicalization of childbirth in the North and in the West. And that people are sort of caught between those two.
Well, and in some countries, going to the hospital for any purpose is going to your death. And so you don't go to the hospital and give birth to a child. That would definitely be the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff in the way that, they manipulate Pharaoh and that they manipulate ideas about other people. Other sort of interactions, or shall we hear from Pharaoh's daughters?
Being older, I knew that I was probably never going to have a child. And so I decided to take the chance. I knew this was a Hebrew baby. I knew that my father would be extremely upset if he knew about this, but it would give me the only opportunity I'd have to be a mother. And so I took that chance. And actually, my father didn't see the baby because I found a nursing mother for this child. And of course, I also knew if there was a nursing mother, she must have had a child at some point, but I didn't go into that because I wanted a child.
I think as Pharaoh's daughter, I know that my father is doing things, but I don't want to know a lot about it. I don't agree with the policy of killing babies, but I'm not the one to question that. But if I see a baby, there's no way I could kill that child. And taking in a Hebrew baby, I know I can do a good deed in giving this child an Egyptian identity and save this child from a life of forced labor by raising him myself and making this child Egyptian. And so I feel very virtuous about what I'm doing because I'm saving this child from his fate if he were to remain Hebrew.
So his life changes, but your life doesn't change so much.
Yeah.
Well, I had this fine baby, and when I saw what a wonderful baby it was, I hid him for 3 months. And when I couldn't hide him any longer, I put him in a basket made of reeds and covered with tar to make it watertight. And then I put the baby in the tall grass at the edge of the river and hoped that somebody would come and pick him up. And they did.
So let's look a little bit more at the Egyptian characters. If the midwives are Egyptian, how do we read that story? And Pharaoh's daughter is clearly Egyptian. David Dobb, who wrote a book called Civil Disobedience in Classical Antiquity, calls the story of the midwives the first recorded incident of civil disobedience in world literature. That the stuff around when Pharaoh calls the midwives and says, why did you do this thing, that the progression of the language and being called into Pharaoh's court is being called, you know, not into the fancy palace, but into the law courts of Pharaoh. And that's the formal language of a criminal charge. And so that this is an act of civil disobedience. And you, I can't remember your name, I'm sorry, talked about being punished afterwards. And it's interesting because it's clear that God rewards the midwives. What's not clear is whether or not Pharaoh punishes them. And they receive, the Hebrew says, they receive houses. We don't know if that's physical buildings, if that means like lineages, if that means what exactly houses means. In some sense, it's kind of a non-traditional making them the head of their household, but it doesn't mean if they were women who had already had children that they escaped punishment. We don't know. We know what God did for them. We don't know what Pharaoh did with them. So that's kind of dicey, kind of up in the air. And so that's a little bit about the midwives. They really kind of blow open Pharaoh's campaign, because he's got a covert campaign of genocide at this point. He's saying, you know, he brings them into a secret meeting and orders them to kill children. Well, by their non-cooperation, they force him to seek the whole of his population as allies, and they make that overt. Pharaoh's daughter has historically been, like whether you look at the Midrash, the commentaries of the rabbis from the time of Jesus on, or whether you look at the movie The Ten Commandments, people are really unwilling to leave Pharaoh's daughter in Egypt. She makes the exodus with the rest of the Israelites. And she's a mysterious character because she comes on for those few verses and then she's gone. We don't know what happens to her, whether she's somebody whose life is profoundly changed by becoming the mother of this child, or whether she's somebody who just raises him to her level of privilege and continues kind of her life in the palace. The question is, like, does Pharaoh's daughter stay a princess, or does she become kind of a race and class traitor? Does she really become somebody who's on the side of the Israelites in a way that kind of permeates her life? And so all of those are kind of models for what does it mean to be somebody who lives in empire, somebody who at some level lives in Egypt, who benefits from the fact that there are slaves in the world. How do we take part in God's liberation project? How could these women be models for us? So maybe I'll just kind of open that up to group discussion and see what folks think.
I know, I always feel about the Pharaoh's daughter that, she did more than she was expected to do. She could have killed the baby, she could have given it to her father, but at the same time, I don't feel like she was a race or class traitor. I feel like she, by adopting Moses, wasn't questioning what was going on. She was merely on an individual level helping an individual. And I feel like when they talk about how Moses grows up and then he sees the Hebrews in slavery, he's very shocked. And to me that makes it seems like she raised him in a palace environment to be Egyptian and not see, not know about how the Hebrews were being treated.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a lot of analysis there, a lot of taking it beyond individual relationship.
Well, I found it interesting what you said about, like, I couldn't have a child of my own, so basically I kidnapped this child. Or let's make it more legit and say, so I go to Africa and adopt a Ethiopian or bring it back to the United States and raise it as a U.S. citizen of privilege, and this person has no clue of what it came from, or what she or he came from, not yet, of its roots and the slavery and, I don't know, I just found it interesting that, I always saw the Pharaoh's daughter as doing this great thing, but maybe she did it simply out of selfishness, that I can't have a child, so I'm going to take your baby, and...
Well, we were talking about that because I had mentioned that it reminded me of the laws that say that a mother who chooses not to keep her child, and it's usually a teenager, young teenager, or a college student, and not always, but usually, and so there's laws that say you can take this child to the hospital, sign the child away with no questions asked, and not be in danger of having broken a law, and which you would do obviously if you abandoned the child or killed the child. But then we also got talking about the adoptions, and many, many Americans do adopt either biracial or other national children, and we think this is such a great thing, and it is. But at the same time, in light of some of the conversations, like the forum the other night where this young man from Korean African heritage was talking about the troubles he had in a very loving family in America, upper class or middle class at least, and yet he didn't know who he was. And I just read an article recently where they were saying the younger children seem to do okay, but when they get to be early teens and late teens and start questioning their identity, there's often great, great problems. And I know that for a fact from a couple from church who had a biracial child, and he just went through great trauma trying to find out who he was. And they had done everything to share his culture. I mean, they did not just, quote, make him white. Of course, our own teenagers do that, whether they're born to you.
Certainly, there's a lot in issues around adoption, around culture, around race. And you know, here is a place to kind of gently have some of those conversations, because certainly there's a lot of families here who are in situations where they have adopted children from other cultures and other nationalities.
Well, Lutheran Social Service
gently probe those justice issues, you know, respectfully and earnestly is I think a really valuable thing to do. But how do we support different kinds of families? How do we seek justice? Because there's sort of the issue of, right now this kid is in the water and there's a crisis. And there's the larger justice issue, and how do we address those simultaneously? What I'd like to do now is, let's see, maybe are there more folks who want to sort of comment on the idea, maybe of the midwives as and their work? You know, what are parallels, modern parallels to that kind of resistance in Egypt?
I don't know very much about the system, but I think midwives are held to be very responsible for their actions. You know, the birth of the babies, and I don't know how it is so much today because I haven't followed it especially, but I read some like medieval times when the midwives, you know, could be, say if a child was born deformed or something, it would be their fault. And so they would run into a terrific amount of difficulty, maybe get killed themselves because the baby didn't turn out right. That's been going through my head. Another thing that's not related is the system in place, I guess, today of mothers who have babies, instead of throwing them in the trash can take them to a safe place that's open a certain hours of the day or night or something. You wrap your baby up and put it in there, this little bin or whatever, and it'll be taken care of. I don't know how good a system that is, what happens to the baby when they receive it on the other end of the bin. Somebody probably knows more about that, but that's the escape route from the dumpster.
I think that varies from state to state. In Ohio, you have to sign the baby away. You can't just leave it.
You can't just quietly but leave it and walk away?
No, because they have to find the name. Well, the reason is they have to have a release. And because this baby can never be adopted if that parent doesn't sign a release.
I just thought that they could
drop
it off, no?
Yeah, but it can go into foster care, but you have to have that release for adoption. At least that's the way it is there. And that's the thing, it varies. Like midwifery in some states is a good thing, and many women use it. In other states, it's so the medical profession has practically eliminated it, or kept it out, I should say, because it was eliminated before and it's just coming back. And so there's a real gray area if somebody chooses to use a midwife today.
So how can we do civil disobedience? How can we be midwives? That's a question.
What do folks think? What are sort of parallels to the things that the midwives were resisting?
Not in the war today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard your group say, you know, surely somebody must be resisting taking part. And there, you know, there have been a variety of specifically civil disobedience campaigns around the war in Iraq. There are a number of conscientious objectors, young men who are in the military, who are sort of in the process of trying to get out of that. So that's an issue, that's something that's going on. Yeah, what else? And this is not a sort of, here are some gargantuan and overwhelming tasks to send you out to do at the end of this week of talking about injustice, but how can we take things on and support one another in ways that are practical and in ways that do make a difference and in ways that don't overwhelm us. So I kind of want to move for the last part of the class into kind of sharing some resources and thinking about how can we be midwives? How can we be, you know, because even Pharaoh's daughter, even if we don't like her, or even if we think that, you know, she was a nice liberal, but didn't really get it, did something. How can we, how can we do something? How can we work together?
Well, I think prayer is the first step to discern what maybe God's calling you to do. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the simplest thing is to write your senator, your congressman, mm-hmm. and voice your opinion.
On part of the Jubilee celebration, we're going to have letter writing. So that's one thing. And that's a nice thing to do in a group where we can support one another. And I'm not certain, the folks at the Resource Center are putting that together. So I'm not sure what they've decided that kind of the issues around that are going to be. But yeah, letter writing is something that folks can do.
Sort of supporting activity, or not activities necessarily, but places such as domestic violence choices, mm-hmm. either financially or, well, in most cases, unless you're really involved, it's pretty much financially because they don't have a lot of volunteers there.
Yeah, other things that people do, things that folks know about. Certainly here there's some nice examples in terms of, one of the classes we did was on slavery and on debt slavery and forced labor around the world, and how do you buy anything without participating in that?
It's almost impossible.
It is almost impossible, and you can make choices in some areas where groups are working on things like fair trade coffee. Mm-hmm. Chocolate is largely harvested by child labor and also by slave labor, and there's fair trade chocolate here where there's a couple of different organizations that have sort of worker-owned cooperatives that harvest and sell chocolate, so that's a possibility. The Resource Center here has a lot of information about just buying stuff. Like garment industry, electronics industry, children's toys, and a lot of food are industries that are really kind of based on exploited labor. Whether that's sort of people who are literally in debt slavery or people who are working for less than they can feed themselves on.
There's the old bumper sticker, think globally and buy locally, but and then in one sense that's the perfect thing to do because you're supporting, like Holden is with their local thing. We belong to a CSA, what is CSA? Community supported agriculture. Things like that. But then after you say that, you think, but who is buying the things that these people are making in other countries? And if nobody's going to buy any of them, then they have absolutely no source of support. And so it gets very mixed up. Our church every couple of years does a CERV sale, and we get consignment from the CERV organization with products that are produced all around the world, and then we also order, have catalogs to order things, and we just, I don't know, we sold like $800-$900 worth of stuff just before Thanksgiving last year. So it's a small step, but, and I guess that's all you can do, but to get in and do everything, there's so many conflictions. Somebody the other day that was here was just telling us that he had been in, was it Nicaragua? And that the coffee plantations, not just the fair share, but the big companies are going bankrupt. Because, is it Vietnam?
Yeah.
Is now making cheaper coffee, cheaper in all senses, and then adding a few grains of good coffee with it. And they're destroying the big coffee makers even in the Central American countries. So it's so complicated.
It is. And one of the, I guess a couple of things I would say to that is, one of the qualities, one of the Egyptian qualities that we sort of listed up here was being efficient, and also, I'm not sure if we talked about it in a different class or this one, but kind of being perfectionist. And that's really a European-based kind of obsession, that we have to get it really right, and we have to do it perfectly. I'm not going to try it if I'm not going to be able to do it. And so that tends to overwhelm people in the work of justice, that we say, well, it's too hard, there's too many things, it's too complicated, rather than saying, well, let's a few of us agree to do one thing, do it together, and to support one another. Something that's really useful, because I find the information really overwhelming, is to say, okay, I'm going to take one issue. One of the things that I've worked on is the campaign to close the School of the Americas, and know a lot about that. And I don't have to know a lot about everything, and through that I've learned some about the history of Latin America, but know who to ask about the other things. If you sort of commit to one thing that you're going to learn about, I think that's a really, it's a valuable discipline. If we think of things as we're taking on not a new purity code, or that it's not making us better, but that if we take on a few things as sort of spiritual exercises, that no, this isn't going to change the world, but that it will sort of change us and incrementally change, that's another way to look.
And to go along with that, especially when we talk about stewardship, it's always about giving more and more and more. But part of that could just simply be less. Like in the 70s, when there was a gas thing, you started driving less. You turned off the lights. I mean, you never walked out of a room without turning off the lights.
You wore a sweater.
Yeah. And so you could just commit to, I'm not going to take this airplane trip this year and save that huge amount of gas that takes,
For example, the hunger awareness meal up here at home. It's like once a week, you have a very, very simple meal, and the money that they save goes to support. So it's both less and giving.
But there's still ice cream.
I know, what's with that?
We did a hunger awareness study during Lent a few years back, and we'd done it in different ways at different times. And this one, our, I guess you could say, culminating activity, we had supper. And we took the percentages of the world population. And so, I forget the numbers anymore, but a very small percentage got a full meal with napkins and placemat. And then you went down to the ones who got rice with goodies that went with it a little bit, and clean water, and then you got the ones that got the plain rice and no water, unless they wanted to go get it from some river. And then we had a table of 10. And so then you had one good meal for each table, which was a little high, but still, and then all the way down. And the fascinating thing was watching people's reactions. At some tables, immediately the one with the full meal started giving away parts. And in other tables, they sort of hunkered over and very embarrassedly ate their meal.
So you had the breakdown was that at each table,
was a percentage, yeah.
So then they had to draw what they were, or how did you?
Well, that's right, I forgot about that part. When they came into dinner, they each took out a ticket, so to speak. And we had them color-coded so they'd be at the right tables. So that you had like one person with a full meal at each table. And as I said, I forget their percentages. It might have been two or three that had the middle meal, and then the rest had the plain rice. And of course, it doesn't work perfectly. We had a couple kids who loved rice and ate everybody's rice.
That's a really valuable exercise. Yeah. I've heard it done.
And we had a great discussion about whether we should have something extra afterwards for the ones that didn't eat. We said, no, they can go home and eat. They have an hour, 45-minute church service after this, and they'll live. And so we had nothing else afterwards. I'd like to do it again, but we had to wait a while for it to sort of be forgotten, you know?
Yeah.
We did a lot of exercise like that, gosh, 15 years ago now, I sort of made a snap decision to be a vegetarian. So there was a meal like that in there. One of the people who was in leadership in the parish, when we were talking afterwards, and our meal hadn't been sort of table by table, that we divided up the gym geographically. And so like Africa got this many people with this much space, and so we did kind of population and space. And so you could see what other people were eating elsewhere. You know, you could hear when they scraped the plates at the one table. But in the discussion afterwards, one of the folks in leadership in the parish was saying, well, it's all dreadful, but we can't do anything about it. And I was like, oh, screw you, buddy. I can do this thing about it.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was a very irresponsible way to take leadership. Yeah, so one of the things is kind of eating lower on the food chain and, you know, doing that occasionally. I think that some of the stuff around addiction and recovery and harm reduction has some useful ways of thinking that can be helpful to us. I think that we are kind of a culture that's addicted to stuff and to consumption. And if we look at that and we say, you know, maybe we need some higher power to deal with this. Maybe we need to you know, have someone that we can call and have support from one another. Also, the idea of harm reduction, the idea that, you know, most people aren't going to be able to go cold turkey, whatever it is that we're subject to. Most of us aren't going to be able to quit tomorrow and walk out of here free, whatever that means.
I haven't had email for 4 days.
Yeah, and that's
But thank God there's chocolate. No, I just trade addictions.
But that's like, you know, that's a treatment center situation. You don't have access to it.
Right. Okay.
So when you go back, you think you'll relapse?
Probably.
Yeah. So what if, you know, what if we define success not as sort of complete purity, but as every time we reduce the amount of harm we do? You know, what if I, you know, didn't eat a factory farmed chicken burger today, but I opted for the veggie patty, or I, you know, bought the more expensive Argentinian non-drugged beef? You know, what if we look at it in terms of because we live in North America, we consume and we do harm. That is a necessary part of what our lives entail. What if we looked at just trying to do less and looked at that as victory? You know, that
even in a very, very poor country, there are people who eat and live very, very well. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very small percentage, but they are there. They're the leaders. They're the ones who have the money. And it may be a half of 1% or less than that even, but there's somebody there. And I think we need to be aware that injustice is all over and that we can only do our part.
Well, if we definitely, you know, none of us is Pharaoh. in Egypt. You know, our position is some ways, scribes, temple keepers, people who keep the system going, but who benefit from the work of slaves. We're not the decision makers, but we do have the capacity to take part in some of the decisions. You know, this is a country where folks can vote. One of the things that we'll be doing is voter registration as part of the letter writing on Jubilee Day.
And we just came from the Global Mission event, and they're within the Senate. They're saying that they have an e-advocacy group and say that letter writing was our present problem, getting letters after 9/11 fast to the legislature. That they've really come to accept email as equal, and sometimes better, as long as you do a good email, like subject this, I believe this, and not just ramble, 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 so that it looks like spam. But if you do it well, they really, really are pushing that. Mm-hmm.
Well, this move.
So your addiction's okay.
Yeah. This moveon.org, I get all their stuff, and they just have a thing where you can send it on.
That's
to your.
I'm going to close with a reading from my book on Exodus, which is available in the bookstore. Next week I'm going to be teaching on the subject of the biblical jubilee and how that's been used in history and what various critiques are, and particularly looking through the lens of the lives of women through history and around the world. So I think that's going to be a fun class. And Thursday next week is the big Jubilee Festival Day, which is going to be great. And we'd love to have folks as involved as they are able to be. There's going to be puppets and music and flags and parades and all manner of exciting stuff. So, a list of precepts and prescriptions and things that one ought to do can seem vague or abstract. And these things can actually be daunting, especially if they are new. Truly, the call to live counter to the world around us carries rigorous demands, but the new life we are promised is exciting and joyful. In small ways around the world, there are individuals, organizations, and communities living out their resistance to empire simply and creatively. Gandhi calls these efforts experiments in truth. As we undertake our own experiments, we First World Christians can be sustained and strengthened by stories, our biblical heritage. The heritage of Exodus is a great and honest gift for privileged readers. Exodus does not diminish the seduction and the appeal of empire, nor does it pretend that salvation can be found there. By reading Exodus and identifying with the Egyptians, we have faced hard truths about ourselves and the way that we serve the empire of global capitalism. Like Egypt, we are complicit in oppression, slavery, and genocide. Facing these truths is the beginning of true conversion. First World Christians live daily in the centers of global capitalism, but together with Shifra and Pua and Pharaoh's daughter, and with one another and whoever else will have us as allies, we can come out of empire. Exodus is the journey of the whole of humanity and of creation towards the resurrection of all flesh and the renewal of heaven and earth. Amen. It is 11:45. Time is up. I just want to do one more plug. The Women's Bible Commentary is available in the bookstore. It is a really excellent resource for just kind of basic Bible study. If you hear a reading from the Book of Amos and you're like, oh, what's the Book of Amos about? It gives you a nice short, what's the Book of Amos about? And then it looks specifically at female characters and particular kind of ways of paying attention to women's stories in the Bible. This is a really excellent resource. I don't know how much it costs. But however much it costs, it's worth it. I have one that I certainly use every week. I have an earlier edition, but it's a very valuable resource. A lot of different people have written on each different book, so I'd like to recommend that to folks. And time to get ready for lunch, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.